Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Here in this episode, we're going to talk about what happened in football history on the Football History Rewind part number 26 in the season of 1908 and early 1909, and the rules changes that were on either side of the playing year based on one big game in 1907, a lot of it came from, and the adoption of the forward pass. And it's all coming up for you in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And we are in our Football History Rewind. Part number 26 is this episode as we go through football history year by year, season by season, rules conference by rules conference. And we are all the way up through the 1907 season. And we're going to talk a little bit about a game played in 1907 and some effects made in the early 1908 season and early 1909. Now, the 1906 and 1907 seasons in review saw only but a few teams trying the newly incorporated forward pass and offensive schemes. The risks in those days almost always outweighed the rewards, as an incomplete pass was a turnover by rule. Now, some teams were modifying that a little bit in even using it as a directional punt, because if you threw the ball on, you know, third down at that time, that was your final down. You had three downs to go 5 yards. They would, you know, fire that ball down the field as far as they could out of bounds. It couldn't be returned, and it was a lot more accurate throwing it than it was kicking the ball in a punt. But in 1907, perhaps the most interesting game where two coaching legends squared off against each other was the Carlisle Indian School, coached by Pop Warner, visiting Amos Alonzo Stagg's University of Chicago 11. Now, Stagg had declared prior to this contest that his 07 team was one of the finest he had ever coached, but he worried about Carlisle and their superior speed. The Carlisle Indian Industrial School was just filled with athletes. Now, Jim Thorpe was on that team, but he really wasn't playing at that time. He was an underclassman. He was a scrawny kid, 115, 120 pounds, wasn't very muscular at all. We cover a little bit in the episodes that we're talking about, Carlisle versus Army 1912, a little bit about the life of Jim Thorpe and how he built himself up. So make sure you check out that series when you get a chance. But Stagg had declared, with the team being so good, that he had to do something to slow down the Carlisle Indians, because their speed was the key. That's what was killing everybody, because they were just so athletic. Now, the Indians played the University of Minnesota just a few days prior to the Chicago game, and the Carlisle quarterback, a man named Mount Pleasant, well, he broke his thumb and had his hip knocked out of whack somehow, where he was unable to play because he couldn't run, couldn't throw the ball, couldn't handle it. And their other star of Carlisle, Albert Exidine, he was hobbled also in that game, but he did plan on playing, but just wasn't his normal self for that game. Well, the worry by Stagg, all the same, knew he had to slow down these quick ends of Carlisle, even though they were injured. And in the book, Carlisle versus Army 1912, Lars Anderson, the author of it, says that Stagg, being a master strategist, decided to have his defenders knock down the ends of Carlisle. He felt they were the key to the great offense that they had. As soon as that ball is snapped, he have each defender tackle, or somehow, I'm assuming tackle, knock down those ends and just keep them to the ground so they couldn't participate in that play at all. And it was extremely effective. They all but nullified the great Carlisle offense. Okay, now it was time for the strategist on the other sideline, Pop Warner, the other genius on the field. He had to come up with a way to, you know, out-duel Stagg's tactic of taking his ends out of play. He too knew that his ends were key. So what he did, Albert Exidine, as soon as the ball was snapped to the backup quarterback, the backup quarterback was instructed to just run around like crazy, dodge players, buy as much time as you can. As that happened, Exidine darted immediately towards the Carlisle sideline. Well, the University of Chicago defenders followed him to the sideline and said, oh, the guy ran out of bounds. He took himself out of the play. Maybe he was hurt. Whatever. You know, so they didn't follow him out of there. They decided to keep playing a game. They went back and tried chasing the quarterback as well. Well, Exidine ran behind his teammates, behind Pop Warner, and downfield behind the bench, and popped out back on the field some 25 yards down the field. And not a defender was within, you know, 20 yards is what it was described. Well, the quarterback, soon seeing this after he bought all that time, launched the ball as far as he possibly could throw it. Exidine's down there by himself. Ball lands in his hands. He walks across the goal line. And that was the eventual backbreaker, the genius of Pop Warner. Now, both of those tactics, you know, Stagg having his defenders tackle the ends, in 1907, that was legal. Albert Exidine being instructed by Pop Warner to run out of bounds and run behind the bench unnoticed by the defenders and pop out some 25 yards downfield and coming back on the playing field, that was legal at the time. Well, ended up that Carlisle won the game 18-4. It was a real backbreaker for that. But just these two geniuses playing, you know, much like Bill Belichick does today, just taking that everything right up to the fine line of what's legal and what's illegal and trying to play the game that way to gain an advantage. Well, these two definitely did that. Well, the rules makers took note also. And in 1908, one of the rules changes was that, you know, they made it illegal for someone on offense to purposely go out of bounds on their own power, not being blocked out, and then to return to try to participate. They called it an illegal participation foul. A few years after that, well, they also made it illegal to tackle somebody that was clearly not an offensive ball carrier. That took care of Stagg's tactic. But needless to say, they both had their effectiveness in that 1907 game. Now, other items at the March 1908 convention, the first passing rule revision was incorporated, and it said any loose ball, when it touched an official, that it was going to be called dead the instant it struck the official, and the down would be replayed. Another rule concerning the pass adopted in 1908 was that only the first receiver to touch the ball after a forward pass was entitled to catch it legally, unless it was touched by an opponent. Now that sounds very familiar, because we just talked about that in the NFL of the 1970s. 1972, that was one of the big points of contention in the Immaculate Reception, because the NFL was going by that same rule from some, you know, almost 70, 65 years earlier in college football, you know, because that's 12 years before the NFL in 1908, where, you know, if the offensive player, the only one that could touch it is the guy that was initially touching it, unless it was touched by a defender, and that was the point of contention. But another rule revision from this session in 1908 on passing deemed that any forward pass across the goal line on the fly, or one that struck the goal post, remember, these goal posts were on the goal line at that time in college, before it touched a player, would be a touchback, and the opposition would gain control of the ball. I guess if it would touch the player first and ricocheted up and hit the goal post, you know, no harm, no foul, it's not a touchback. This meant that a receiver had to catch a pass in a field of play and then cross the goal line to score, and throws to the end zone were merely turnovers. So, yeah, you couldn't catch the pass in the end zone. So, sounds very foreign to the way we think of football today, but they had to catch it, you know, maybe catch it at the 1-yard line and cross the goal line, you're legal. Catch it in the end zone, sorry, ball's a touchback across the goal line before it was touched. So just some really strange rules to us. Other revisions of 1908 were not pass-related, were that the score of a forfeited game would be 1-0, and at halftime intermission should be 15 minutes in length. Those are still done in high school and college football. You know, there you can have an expanded halftime, not a 20 minutes. If you know, in high school, if you have both bands playing, I think college has pretty much gone to a 20-minute halftime. But a forfeit being 1-0, that started all the way back in 1908. It's still effective today, at least in the high school game. Now, the referee would notify both teams when 3 minutes remained in the intermission, and also would blow his whistle from midfield when the intermission had expired. Still pretty common practices today. I don't know, you know, the officials need to tell the locker rooms that 3 minutes left in the half so they get back on the field in time. It's a courtesy, and so you don't want to have a penalty thrown. Not so much does he blow his whistle from midfield when intermission's expired, but remember we have these big boxes of numbers and horns on the end zones. The scoreboard operator, we gave that duty to him. So instead of the whistle, we have the big buzzer going off to say intermission is expired. And should a team not be on the field within 2 minutes after the whistle blow, then the ball will be put in play by the offended team at their own 30-yard line. That was the rule back then. Now it's a 15-yard penalty, and you know, you go into the second half kickoff with that 15-yard penalty being enforced. Now, during the season of 1908, retroactively, the LSU Tigers football team was declared as the champions of college football in 1908. Those Louisiana State University Tigers were coached by Edgar Wingard, and they posted a perfect 10-0 record, outscoring opponents 442-11. And I believe that is the first time a Southern team, traditional Southern team, was crowned as the national champion. So it was retroactively many years later, but I believe it's the first time it wasn't a team from the East as claiming that title. In the professional game 1908, it was the Akron Indians who won the Ohio state championship that year. And that's pretty much for those period of time there in the early 1900s, whoever won Ohio, they were pretty much the champions of professional football, because that was the best game of pro ball being played was in that Ohio league. So Akron Indians were your champions. LSU Tigers were the college national champions. So two kind of different teams that we haven't heard of before winning their first titles. Now, March 27th, 1909, there was another convention. And this one must have been fairly short and sweet, as there was not a lot of changes came from it. A goal from the field became worth 3 points. So that's pretty substantial. That was at this meeting, that's the first time the field goal was worth 3 points. So you can answer that in your trivia question at your local watering hole, the 1909 convention. Also, an inadvertent whistle was mentioned by the football rules makers. And it's a new rule which stated that the referee should never blow his whistle to indicate a foul. And if he did so inadvertently, the ball would become dead and play would stop. So yeah, inadvertent whistle. If for those of you who don't know, it's a whistle that should not have been blown. You know, it's very embarrassing. I can tell you when you're wearing stripes, you have an inadvertent whistle. I think everybody that's officiated had at least one in their lifetime. And you know, I had a very unfortunate story of when I was a younger official. I thought a runner had got stopped, got tackled. Ended up being a very good fake by the other team. And here I'm blowing my whistle and a kid's running around the opposite end for a score. So, you know, as I say, watch the ball, know where the ball is. I don't assume just because that kid took a great fake and plowed in the line and got tackled. And it was very embarrassing because it was against my sideline. I was a sideline official, and coach was pretty gracious on me. He could have been a lot harder than he was, but it was still pretty embarrassing situation, and everybody in the stands having to call back that team touchdown. That poor kid would have scored. Fortunate, but it happens, and it's embarrassing. Well, the first time they mentioned inadvertent whistle, 1909 convention. Another concept of designing a player as either a lineman or a backfield player was instituted, and the rule stated that a player who is more than 1 foot back of the scrimmage line but less than a yard back from it was not eligible to receive a forward pass. That's kind of a different rule than we're used to. There's also a large discussion on a diagram created regarding positions of players and a name of each position. This diagram and naming was incorporated into the rules. So some of the traditional things of the snapper back and the quarterback and fullback, well, those were sort of official now to the rules, these positions. The season itself in 1909 was less productive than the sessions held by the rules makers. As a matter of fact, one could say it was counterproductive. Many teams went back to the old strategy of unwinding coil, like blocking schemes. And these strategies picked on a defensive tackle positions and really created another large count of injuries for the 1900 season. So they're just keying on just the key points of the defensive line, just attacking it with multiple players, blocking those poor defensive tackles and gaining advantage and running off those tackles. Again, there was public outcry against the game of football because of this, and talk of the sport's abolishment once again were voiced by citizens and politicians across the country, just like it was a few years earlier. Walter Camp and those who sided with him pointed out that the mass momentum, interlock blocking, and offside interference stunts were the main culprits that made the game extremely dangerous, and they were right. The committee created by Chancellor McCracken for the first time assembled under the name of the National Collegiate Athletic Association, or NCAA. Another trivia question, 1909 convention, NCAA. It was born. The organization put the burden of remedying the ailing game to their rules committee of the NCAA, and the rules committee responded with covering in many tedious sessions to fix the game, and they became the most strenuous reform meetings in the game's history. The committee decided to hammer out a new code and change the game forever. It was not favored by everyone, but the solution over many big changes not the only thing that could possibly save the game for this point in time. It was the only thing that could save the game at this time. The public allowed a few minor alterations in times past to keep the game on campuses, but this time little changes were not good enough. The game must be radically changed to sway the public perception in order for it to survive. They had to get rid of those mass momentum plays, those interference stunts, and the interlock blocking. You had to get rid of those, and they did. And we're going to find out more about that next week in our Football History Rewind segment, part number 27, when we get into the 1909-1910 seasons in the rule revisions and the champions on the field. We're sure glad that you joined us here once again. We hope that you join us next week for Football History Rewind. We hope you join us each and every day here on the Pigskin Daily History Podcast, where we bring you some great football each and every day. And we're going to be coming at you with all these great stories and trying to reminisce about football past. And we hope that you are enjoying this format and what we're doing here. And, beginning of the week, we talk about early pro football teams. We then try to get into some books and have some guests on if we can, and some authors. We have our Football History Rewind, and we try to wrap everything up in a nice bow. Also, you can check out more sports history on our sister website and podcast, the Sports Jersey Dispatch at jerseydispatch.com. Or join us for our friends, along with our podcast, on the Sports History Network, where we have about 27, 28 different podcasters going crazy there, just bringing you sports history and a lot of different subjects. And we hope you enjoy that. So until tomorrow, everybody, have a great Gridiron Day. We're taking a peek over at the chains and the down marker. It's fourth and long. We're going to have to punt the ball and get on out of here, but we'll have another series tomorrow for your football history headlines, so be sure to tune in. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast. PigskinDispatch.com is a proud affiliate of the Sports History Network, the headquarters of sports yesteryear.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that, Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts. It's found right here on the Sports History Network.